Thanks very much, and it's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to speak, I think, a little bit more directly to the topic of the panel, which is the role of the policy intellectual in economic issues. And I want to begin with the proposition that there are no purely scientific answers to policy questions. Uncompensated distributive effects are ubiquitous. And so to take up where Joe left off, the battle is for the nature of society. I've never seen it in any other terms, despite my nominal training as an economist. A policy intellectual is therefore always either a committed participant in that battle, or else perhaps a hypocrite or a fool who either pretends not to be or believes that they're not. You start with certain values and you pursue them. And those values may be justice, peace, equality, liberty. The values that you value may change and may differ, and so policy intellectuals can entertain honest differences. And it is possible, remotely possible, even for conservatives to be intellectuals on occasion. One of the pleasures of working on the Joint Economic Committee in the early 1980s, as Richard Kaufman and I discovered, was that there were a smattering of policy intellectuals on the other side. And so we made a practice of calling them up to testify several times a week so that we could debate things back and forth, and actually remain friends with them for many years afterwards. So it is possible, I'll give you that case in point. But there is a basic rule, which is that a policy intellectual is a principal, not an agent. You can work on a team of shared purpose, but you may not be bought or rented. You are not a lawyer for hire. You are not a flack. And in that setting, the role of rationality is instrumental. It's a method of analysis. It's a method of design, policy design, persuasion. But it is also a constraint. If you take that principle seriously, you have to accept the constraint even at the price of losing a certain number of battles. In my case, practically everyone that I've ever fought. You can go over to a philosophy of win at all cost, but in that situation, you're no longer actually a policy intellectual. And people who do that, sometimes if they were once in that role, they find the psychological transition very difficult. Henry Kissinger, actually, is probably the Ur example of this in our time. That would take a longer exposition, but I think it's a fair statement. In my career, I have had many interesting policy engagements, beginning with the attempt to rescue New York City back in 1976, for several years with the debates over the Reagan economic program when I was at the Joint Economic Committee in the early 1980s, the debt crises in Latin America and elsewhere in the 1990s. I was a participant in providing advice and counsel to the Chinese government on economic reform. In the 2000s, I was basically in a role of unmitigated resistance to the horrors of the George W. Bush administration. But the most interesting of these was the most recent, which was 6 months, 5 or 6 months, that I spent in the early part of 2015 as a kind of friend and counselor to the finance minister of the government of Greece, to my friend Yanis Varoufakis. And since that was perhaps the most interesting and intricate example of the relationship between a rational policy program and the vested interest, I thought perhaps I could spend my time here telling you a little bit about it. It is recounted in full detail here in this book, which is translated as Welcome to the Martyr's Arena in the Greek edition, but Welcome to the Poison Chalice in English. In 2010, at the outset of the European financial crisis, Greece's creditors, notably the infamous Troika of the European Commission, European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, imposed a settlement on that country for a complex of political reasons. The French and the German governments wanted, above all, to rescue their banks, which were weakened by losses that had stemmed from the financial crisis originating in the United States and threatened by the possibility of sovereign defaults in the European periphery. The European Central Bank, which was headed at that time by a Frenchman, wanted to assist especially the French banks by buying up, in particular, Greek debt, which it did at a discount, in order to get those risky assets off the books of the threatened institutions. The International Monetary Fund, which by that point was basically out of business in the Third World, is doing most of its work in Turkey because of the failures of decades of neoliberal policies for which it had been responsible, wanted something to do. And so getting involved in Europe seemed like a good idea. In addition to that, there is the fact, which was attested to by in testimony before the Greek Parliament by a senior advisor to the president of the European Commission at the time, the president of the managing director of the IMF, a man of impeccable ethics by the name of Dominique Strauss-Kahn, as I'm sure you recall, wanted to get engaged because he thought it would help him become president of France. This he did, I do not hesitate to mention, with your American taxpayer dollars, so just bear that in mind. And Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, needed the IMF on board in order to impose a program that would give the rescue package credibility with the German Bundestag so that she could get a package which essentially laundered a rescue for the North European banks through the Greek state and at the expense of the Greek citizenry. And the result was a program, essentially a standard but exceptionally harsh structural adjustment program consisting of massive cuts in spending, especially in pensions and in the civil service, 300,000 or so people laid off, very much higher tax rates, especially sales taxes, value-added tax, deregulation, and fire sale privatizations of practically every valuable asset held by the Greek state. This formula, recognizable to anybody who had been part of the policy debates over the adjustment to the debt crisis in the 80s and 90s, was backed by official forecasts which no one believed, not the staff of the IMF, not the other directors of the IMF, but which was generated by their economists as this kind of reversion to mean of GDP growth. It's expected that the Greek economy would recover in full in about 3 years, that there would be a year or two of recession and then a strong recovery of growth. The actual result, as everybody knows, was a complete collapse of investment in Greece, a drop of 25% of national income, an unemployment rate well above 20-25% for young people in the range of 50-60%, substantial immigration, about 800,000 of a population of 11 million so far, and the destruction of public services in Greece, healthcare, education, transportation, as well as the destruction of three Greek governments, the socialist government of George Papandreou, the technocratic government of Lucas Papademos, and the right-wing government of Antonio Samaras, which led to the election of 2015 and the installation of Yanis Varoufakis, a visiting professor at the time at the University of Texas at Austin, as finance minister, at which point I got an email which said, get here as soon as you can. The new government presented what was in fact a model, if I do say myself, so myself, of rational policy backed by substantial argument to the creditors, a model of changes of the most egregious and most deeply flawed and conspicuously failed elements of the 2010-2012 programs. There were four central elements in what they were seeking to do. The first was to get a feasible target for the so-called primary surplus, rather than a completely unachievable 4.5% target, which was simply put into the program in order to reconcile the irreconcilable, that is to say, this fiscal condition with the requirement of debt sustainability analysis. Instead, far from being a Keynesian expansionary program, the new government simply wanted to get something that it might be able to achieve, a target in the range of 1-1.5%. The second was an end to an unethical experiment in complete labor market deregulation, which had not been tried anywhere in Europe and which violated the standards of the International Labor Organization. Our position was that the ILO standards should apply in Greece as they do everywhere else. The third was the protection of the very lowest income pensioners, those who were already essentially destitute, receiving on the order of 350 euro a month, and protecting them from proposed cuts of another 120 euro or so from the small pittances that we're already getting. A population of fragile and impoverished people. And the fourth was an end to privatizations on a fire sale basis on the proposition which I think any minimally trained economist can accept, which is that when you put all your assets on the auction block at once, the tendency is to get quite a low price. And this was what was happening in Greece. The privatization program that had been announced was, to the extent that it was moving at all, was not bringing in but a fraction, a small fraction, of the revenues that were supposed to come in. So it was not for the benefit of the Greek state, but simply moving assets from the public to the private sector. Point about these four points is that no one at any level in the negotiations that followed contested the merits of these changes, of these proposals. And the Greek finance minister, Yanis, was told to his face directly by a very honest interlocutor, the German finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, that he knew that the program was not working and would not work for Greece. This was not a secret at any level in the discussions. There were negotiations at three levels. At the technical level, that is to say, with the creditors themselves, with the officials of the IMF, the European Commission, and the European Central Bank, the Greeks found themselves faced with negotiating partners who had no mandate to negotiate, whose mandate was instead to review the performance of the existing program, to extract concessions in the direction of compliance, and then to move on to the next item of the agenda. Not to make, and they were not authorized to make any corresponding concessions, so in some sense those negotiations were a pure sham. Discussions of a more authoritative sort could have been conducted and were conducted at the level of the finance ministers, the so-called Eurogroup, an ad hoc agency or an ad hoc collection of the 19 finance ministers of the Eurozone. But here you had a problem, which was that the finance ministers, who represent the most conservative ring of conservative governments, were ideologically committed to no concessions. The East Europeans were had from governments that were austerity, ideologically committed to austerity. The Iberians were afraid of granting concessions that might embolden left-wing movements in Portugal and in Spain. The French were sympathetic but didn't want to stand up to the Germans. The Italians were sympathetic but didn't want to waste political capital on the Greeks. And the Germans were intent upon holding the whole of Europe together under the authority of the German finance ministry and not allowing any concessions that might endanger their ability to impose similar programs in Rome and in Paris. And that, too, was said explicitly to Yanis Varoufakis. And so we were driven to try and resolve this at the political level, essentially making the case, which I think could have been made, could and was made quite clearly, that the future of Europe depended upon there being some scope for the election of governments with divergent philosophies and divergent approaches to policy. And that appeal was made directly by Prime Minister Tsipras to Chancellor Merkel. It was made indirectly through the United States government. And it resulted ultimately in a failure insofar as the German chancellor chose instead to effectively take the step of destroying the independence of the Greek government rather than accommodating it. The United States could have intervened to protect the autonomy of the Greek state, but it did not because ultimately in the U.S. case, the higher consideration was getting Chancellor Merkel on side with respect to Ukraine. And so Greece was sacrificed to that. None of this had anything to do with the discussion over what was rational economic policy for Greece. That's the point. It was all about the vested interest and political constraints in this enormously complex operating environment, which is now a modern Europe. And I would argue that the that situation is what is behind substantially the Brexit vote, the rise of Marine Le Pen, and the Eurosceptic movements all across Europe, which are on the verge of putting the European project in mortal peril. But it gets worse, and I'll wrap up momentarily. Because in addition to defeating the efforts of the Greek government to negotiate a better deal for their own country, there was a campaign at the Greek and European levels of character assassination directly focused on Yanis Varoufakis as an individual, that is to say, the one rational economist in this picture, and believe me, Yanis is exactly that. Those who know him, I think, well, will attest that I'm not speaking personally from personal affection alone. There was an attack on him as a character matter. There was an attack on him and on me for having developed in secret and very discreetly a plan B in case Greece were forced to exit the Eurozone by the actions of the European Central Bank. And there is the risk, if the present government falls, that the attacks will turn from a simple tax in the media to attacks through the legal system, which could end up in a very nasty situation. So we're dealing with people who are not only intent upon defeating rational policy, but in fact on stamping it out, first by the tactic of belittlement and ridicule, but ultimately by the tactics of punishment. Could this happen in the United States? Of course not. Here we argue policy on the merits, we avoid ad hominem and ad feminem attacks, and we decide contested questions by fair votes. Thank you very much.